The battle was over. At least 8,000 Aborigine warriors lay in the desert staring up at the first stars to appear in a sky befouled with smoke and dust. An ashy pallor had fallen over Uluru, at whose base their slayers had encamped. Behind it, the day died in fire and blood, just another casualty of the charnel house. A pavilion had been erected in the midst of camp, a great gaudy tent of some synthetic that was silk to the eye, but that repelled soil and stain. Within, the God King toasted victory with Vladek and Thulia, with pale wine, in air-conditioned comfort. The Dewa Raja's beautiful but immobile face reflected only serenity. Not so his guests. A dozen hooded ones tittered to one another, with heads together. Vladek, the coarse black hair gone from the back of his head to show a rough ellipse of scalp, scorched angry pink, stood in a fresh black uniform, almost vibrating from the thrill of spilling blood. He was too exalted to sit, which was good, since sitting was none too comfortable for him, and wouldn't be for a while yet. His quick action had preserved himself and Thulia from the full effects of the frag and incense grenades the intruders had left on the witchwoman's corpse, but not all. The fireball that consumed the Sekhmen in the torture chamber had caught him from behind.
I still don't see, Your Majesty. Achoo! Why we don't send a party to secure the caverns at once?
He had barely wet his pointy, pale tongue in the wine. He couldn't taste anything. The tense refrigerated air aggravated the sinus condition brought on by the abominable dryness of this abominable land.
Is our victory, then, not sufficient for your pleasure, cousin?
He just wants out of this wasteland as quick as possible. I don't blame him.
Cultivate patience. The secrets that lie within have waited millennia. They will wait until the morning. Our troops are tired. It might render them clumsy. We can afford to have nothing damaged.
That accursed apekin bitch Van Sloan and Baron Beausoleil thought they had the rock secured.
Too late, he realized he might have spoken a little too candidly with one of Erica Van Sloan's sworn minions in his presence. Vladek was a frighteningly powerful and thrustful man. His streak of violence ran wide and near the surface, even for an apekin. Yet he only snorted and quaffed wine. Thulia felt a fresh stab of grievance like an ice pick in the belly. How little regard he has for me, an overbeing, a baron.
Yet they were repulsed, driven out in the end.
Let them bring their flesh-eating bats. Our radar-aimed machine cannon will rip them to pieces the way we did the savages themselves.
Their magic has failed in the face of superior force and will. The matter is as simple as that.
Thulia cringed in terror as an explosion thundered right outside the God King's pavilion. Blue light flashed, a lance-like line so bright it was clearly visible through the fabric of the tent.
What's this? What's going on?
Vladek formed a fist of his left hand. His sin eater purred into it.
Bastards committing suicide. Simple as that.
With Victor's arrogance, if not baronial arrogance, the invaders had made a small oversight selecting the location of their command pavilion. A narrow gully snaked through the encampment. It passed within 30 yards of the tent's left rear corner. From the arroyo's nearest approach rose 11 men, 10 surviving Aborigines, two of them tech boys armed with the rare neutron hand blasters, and Kane. Through the treacherous late twilight, they stole toward the back of the tent. It was a good time for a sneak attack. The human eye had not yet fully adjusted to the absence of sunlight, and in the dimness, the human body naturally tended toward a relaxed, less than wholly attentive state. But hundreds of men were awake and moving all around, and the tent was well guarded by the God King's Sekhmen, armed with both swords and blasters, who knew well the price of anything less than total vigilance when guarding their master's person. A black-turbaned mag loomed up abruptly from the gloom, walking toward the gully, probably for a quick leak, too far from any raider to be quickly silenced. Kane shot him once through the center of the forehead with his sin-eater, then lobbed a grin toward the tent. It struck a Sekhmen hurrying around the corner in the face, and exploded, obliterating the upper half of him in a searing yellow-white flash. The night awoke around them with answering flashes like fireflies on jolt, the muzzle flames of dozens of blasters firing on the infiltrators at once. The firing was exuberant, the more so since the bulk of it was done by men who had never handled an actual blaster until weeks or days before. What was really happening was that the startled soldiers were shooting in all directions from the midst of their own camp. Far more bullets smacked home in the flesh of their own fellows than found intruders. Inevitably, some struck the pavilion as well. Kane used a tri-burst from his own Sinister as he slogged toward the big tent at the greatest speed his full-body armor permitted, just as a blue bolt flared and crashed from behind him. A wag blew up in an orange flash, followed by shrieks as occupants spilled out as torches. Kane himself felt a nutshot of despair as he watched the tent side flex in response to his tri-burst, then clearly shed the bullets without holes appearing. Bullet-resistant fabric. Well, this way I'll know the fuckers are dead, he told himself. A bull boy, matching him stride for stride, firing an M16 from either hand, grunted and tumbled into a rolling confusion of dust and ragdoll limbs as a machine gun burst raked them. The bullets clattered against Kane's polycarbonate hard contact suit, staggering him but failing to penetrate. Shedding bullets, Kane reached the tent, ran around to the front, replacing the box in his Sin-Eater's magazine well. One of the Dewa Raja's guards met him coming out the flap. The sick man hacked at Kane's head. Kane blocked the cut with an upflung forearm. As he jammed the sword cut, Kane let his hand blaster snap back into his forearm holster. He'd need all the bullets in the mag and more in just a moment, with little prospect of a chance to reload. Then he drove his right fist into the black-clad man's gut. The turbaned God King Sekman bent slightly at the middle as breath oofed out of him. Then he straightened. The inertia of his undercoat of mail had absorbed Kane's punch. He grinned triumphantly until Kane imploded his face for him with a forward smash of his polycarbonate-clad elbow. Kane threw the faceless man from his path. From a wallaby hide pouch slung around his waist, he grabbed a handful of micrograns, armed them quickly. His Suicide Squad's few survivors were fighting to keep the invaders converging on the God King's tent off his back. They couldn't possibly buy him more than a fistful of seconds. Hopefully, that's all he'd need. He stuck his arm into the tent flap and scattered four of the little gleaming globes of death. He turned then, Sin-Eater slapping his hand and blazing instantly into life. Charging enemies were bowled over, howling as bullets stormed through their vitals and smashed their limbs. Behind him, he heard a ripple of thuds. Prepping another tiny grin in his left hand, keeping the Sin-Eater in his right, he pushed inside the command tent. Right away, he saw the God King standing in the pavilion's rear. His inhumanly beautiful face was as immobile as an ice sculpture, set with a look of amused disdain. Before him, a phalanx of hooded ones pointed infrasound wands at Kane. Between him and them were a gaggle of the black-uniformed Coldhearts, some standing, some writhing from absorbing the brunt of the microgren blasts, and some not moving at all. Vladek and Baron Thulia stood beside the God King. Vladek raised his Sin-Eater and fired a tri-burst over the hooded ones' heads and right between ranks of Sekman up front, showing how much he cared about risk to his comrades. All three metal-jacketed bullets slammed the breastplate right over Kane's heart. The impacts clacked his teeth together and drove him back a step. He had no clear shot at the Dewa Raja, so he lobbed his ready microgran at the perfect golden head. Vladek reached up and batted it down. It bounced off the back of a hybrid's cowl and dropped right between Vladek's feet and the God King's, bringing them both inside its radius of lethal effect. Vladek grabbed Baron Thulia by a shoulder and pitched him face down on top of the gleaming sphere. The Baron's frail body rose a foot into the air on a cushion of silver-white glare. His right arm flew away, trailing scarlet strings to bounce off the tent wall. Kane blasted his Sin-Eater full auto at the God King. Vladek, unarmored for the victory celebration, ducked behind the Sekman and hybrid standing before him, drawing the foreign Baron down with him. The hooded ones opened fire with their wands. Caught between invisible beams and equally invisible bullets, the human guards could only scream, dance, and die. Kane's Sin-Eater ran dry. He smashed it across the bearded face of a still-standing Sekman. The mag roared and fell back a step. Then the right side of his body seemed to quiver, and compound balloons of blood and shreds of flesh erupted out of him as several infrasound beams struck him at once. An infrasound beam brushed the side of Kane's helmet. It felt like fabric ripping in his brain. His tooth root stung, and fat yellow spots danced behind his eyes. He lunged forward, smashing a hard-shelled fist down on a hooded head, feeling the thin, outsized hybrid skull pop like a great egg. More beams struck him. The armor prevented them from taking direct effect on his body, but the vibrations they passed punished him like spiked fists. He staggered, the wind driven from his lungs, vision swimming in red as chunks of tough synthetic began to be blasted from his armor. He drove himself forward by the sheer force of his hate. One more step, another after that, and I'll feel the God King's windpipe collapse beneath my fingers. After that, he didn't care. A black shape hurtled toward him. Before Kane could react, the bull-rushing Vladek tackled him around the middle and slammed him onto his back.
Enough!
His voice all but drowning the rising thunder of the earthquake and the building coming down about their ears, Bush Baby Bob tossed Grant from his path as if the Big X Mag were a child and charged into the room.
Bob! No!
He ignored her. Bridget tried to control her terror as fist-sized shards of ossified acoustic tile clattered down on the top of her rat suit helmet. The fear of the silent, hideous death of rat exposure warred with fear of being entombed alive. She managed to hold on, barely. An overstressed wooden beam broke. A section of the upper story fell with it, perhaps a ton driving it like a jagged tipped lance against the bull boy's side. Bridget heard ribs shatter even above the grinding tumult. Bob half spun. The huge mass drove down and past him. The raw end tore open the whole side of his rad suit, exposing a shirt already sodden black with blood. Rita tried to lunge in to the bull boy's aid. Grant picked himself up in time to seize her arm in an iron grip.
If you get chilled, he dies in vain.
The walker glared fury at him, then melted, weeping, into his arms. Nobby pushed past them into the still clear part of the room right by the door.
Oh, no!
Watch yourself, mate!
Behind Billy Handsome's faceplate was a mask of agony. There was nothing he could do right now for his friends, for his people, but watch and wait.
Got it! I've got it! Got the turtle!
He reappeared, staggering through a swirl of dust. He stretched out his left hand, pressed something into Nobby's gloved palm. The whole upper floor fell in. Half mad with pain, half blind, half deaf, Kane lashed out with armored forearms that were still lethal weapons. But Vladek had him in the classic mount position, thighs around hips, pinned. It was a simple matter for the big Cobaltville mag to get his palms on Kane's biceps and use his full weight to drive his arms down. Not all of the human guards had been taken out. Three jumped forward in response to the God King's shrilled command to secure the now helpless Kane. Leering down in triumph beneath his one black brow, his scar pulsating crimson against his pale face, Vladek swung off Kane and stood, dusting his hands off against each other. Kane's mag helmet, with its slightly concave red visor, was wrenched cruelly from his head. A strap cut his left ear across. He was lifted half upright, then dragged before the Dewa Raja, with his armored toes scraping the exquisite Bokhara carpet. A Sekhman grabbed his head.
Kneel before the majesty of the God King, you dog.
Kane was rammed down on his knees. Blood-matted hair hung in his eyes. Although his head weighed a ton, he made it swing side to side to shift the hair away. He blinked. His vision cleared somewhat. Then he raised his face to stare at the Dewa Raja. The hybrid stood gazing down on him with huge blue eyes. He appeared as much some exotic bird as human, and the wispy crest of bright yellow hair crowning his high, pale scalp only reinforced the effect.
Mr. Kane, you have caused much trouble to my kind. I admit I have small reason to love my North American cousins who drove me forth decades ago. Yet the natural order must be preserved, as even you must certainly admit. Animals who rise against their masters must be destroyed. And the survivors of the Nine might find the supremacy my seizing Uluru and its secrets confers upon me an easier pill to swallow if I send them your head as a sweetener.
The fatigue of failure was overcoming even Kane's vanadium steel will. His head slumped. A big hand, hairs like coarse black threads stark against its pallid skin, grabbed his chin and forced his face back up, nails gouging jaw and cheek.
Manners, Kane! Have you degenerated so far that you've forgotten a magistrate always shows respect to his betters?
Show me some, and I'll respect the fuck out of them. But not this bug-eyed taint.
He barely felt the backhand blow that torqued his head around on his neck so savagely his cervical vertebrae squealed against each other and red sparks shot up through the back of his skull. He let his head roll over and around and cocked an eye at Vladek, who had struck him.
And I'm not a magistrate any longer, you worthless piece of shit.
Enough! If your object is to annoy me sufficiently to spare you a lingering death, Mr. Kane, you have succeeded. Senior Magistrate Vladek, blow out this renegade's brains.
It's way too good for him, but it'll be my pleasure, God King.
Vladek held up his left hand and formed it into a half-open fist. His sin-eater appeared in his hand. He lowered it slowly, deliberately, toward Kane's face, running his swollen, pallid maggot of a tongue over his fleshy lips in anticipation. Then, to Kane, it was as if everything shimmered. Him, the air, the world. air. Cool, sweet air, caressing his face like a lover's fingers.
Oh, I'm alive.
You're welcome, Kane.
He made his eyes open. Although his eyelids were puffed and glazed with drying blood, as if he'd just gone 15 rounds with a champion heavyweight boxer and lost every one, the rest of him felt that way too, except the parts that felt worse. A wide, dark shadow rose against a starry sky. By the flickering glow of a nearby campfire, he made out a familiar, long-jawed face, mouth framed by a long mustache and set into a permanent-seeming scowl.
Grant?
Last time I checked.
Water. I'm dry as rad bones.
Kane looked around to see Lilga hunkering beside him, proffering a pottery jug. Without ceremony, she tipped it and sloshed cool, clean water into his open mouth. He heard fizzing inside his skull as the cells of his dehydrated tongue absorbed water. Nodding the girl thanks, he took the jug, shoved himself into a seated position. He turned his head and spit the remnants of the first mouthful of water into the dirt, then glugged greedily from the wide mouth of the earthenware vessel. He shook his head, then held up the jug and poured water over his face. Shaking his head again and blowing, he became aware of the cool, astringent smells of conifers and the sweetness of moist earth.
Mountains. We're in the mountains. The camp?
All together again.
Kane was struck from two sides simultaneously, a double hug forcing the air from his chest like a bellows. He made a croaking noise at the agony in his ribs.
Domi? Baptiste?
The latter detached herself and stood back from him briskly.
Good to have you back alive, Kane.
Doesn't feel that way.
He gently detached Domi, who was pressing too tight upon his ribs, which seemed to have been replaced with scythe blades.
Thanks to the heroism of friend Grant and the lovely and gifted Rita, you might just survive to see another dawn, my dear boy. Thanks to the sacrifice of Bush Baby Bob, we all might get to
Lakesh.
Kane turned his head to see an unearthly figure. The somewhat spindly doctor was naked but for a loincloth, body and face daubed with swirls of coarse red and yellow paint. Beside him stood a sturdy middle-aged man and the inevitable old man, each similarly decorated.
Hello, old man. And you must be Yindi.
The other nodded.
Welcome, Mr. Kane.
Kane tried to stand, couldn't. Grant reached down and hauled him to his feet. He swayed. Instantly, Domi and Bridget were back at his sides, holding him up.
Easy. I think I'm broken.
He realized he was wearing only a pair of sweatpants. The cool mountain breeze soothed his tortured skin.
Nothing serious. Your hard contact suit sucked up most of what the wands dealt out. You look like you've been used to hammer railroad spikes, though.
Petechiae. Capillaries ruptured just below your skin. Blooming bruises, akin to the symptoms of low-level irradiation. They will fade in a few days.
Kane looked at him again.
Why are you naked and covered in paint?
Not precisely naked, my boy, as you can plainly see. Old man and the excellent Yindi are allowing me to take part in the Grand Korobori in progress.
Funeral rites for the human race, huh?
Bitterness welled up within him with such force his vision literally blackened for a moment.
You're fused! Talking crazy, we won!
Bullshit. We were slaughtered. Why aren't I dead, by the way? Didn't Vladek blow my brains out, just like the God King told him to?
Rita far walked in with Grant just as Vladek was about to pull the trigger on you. Grant dropped flashbang stun grenades, then grabbed you, and they all jumped right back out.
So that's what the sound and light show was. Not Vladek evacuating my skull. I don't suppose you got a chance to drop off a few handfuls of microgrens on your way out.
Negative. Weren't going to use real bombs going in, so we wouldn't chill ourselves, not to mention you. And we had to get you out as close to instantly as possible or die a lot, which would have obviated the whole damn exercise. Place was full of cold hearts.
Evidently more invaders had rushed to the God King's aid. But Grant's words confirmed Kane's worst fears. The God King still lived, as for that matter did Vladek. Not that Vladek meant shit, but it rankled Kane's ass that the maggot would live to celebrate victory. Except...
Domi said we won. What did she mean?
He pushed the two women aside as gently as he could so he could stand alone. Neither took exception. Yindi held out a broad hand. Its palm was covered by a smooth, rounded shape that seemed to gleam green and gold in the firelight.
The Mackenzie Turtle. Our friends recovered it from the heart of a cataclysm. One of ours was lost.
Kane felt his knees start to buckle.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for Mary Alice and Tyree and Warboom Ben. I'm sorry for the 10,000 good men who got butchered like animals today.
We are all sorry. It is why we dance. We dance their spirits back into the dream time.
You got the turtle.
Kane accepted the artifact from the shaman. It was cool, hard, and as smooth as glass. Strangely pleasing to the touch, and after a moment he became aware it seemed to be pulsing gently in his palm. Or maybe that was his heartbeat he felt.
This is it? All this suffering and dying over a chunk of carved... what is it?
Malachite, a basic carbonate of copper.
That's still a rock, right?
A mineral, but yes.
It is not what it is made of, but how what it was made of is arranged. The information encoded in its very crystalline structure. And the power.
The power? Is it a weapon?
Oh no, Mr. Kane.
Kane tossed it rudely back to Yindi.
Then begging your three wise men's pardons, I don't see it means glowing nuke shit. Because the God King is camped all around Uluru with a fucking mechanized army, and without some kind of hellacious damn superwep, there they will stay until they've done whatever it is you were all so hot and bothered for fear they would do.
Just because the Mackenzie Turtle is not a weapon does not mean it is not the instrumentality that will undo our enemies. Now, if you please, my friends, come along. The ceremony's about to begin.
It was a great bowl amid tree-clad peaks, shadow shapes against the stars. In the very middle of it, a space perhaps 30 yards across lay clear, and in the midst of that, two fires blazed high. Otherwise, the valley was full of people, tens of thousands of them, sitting and chanting softly. A great knee of rock jutted from the mountainside into the cleared space. Upon its bald end perched the folk from Cerberus. With them sat Billy Handsome, Nobby the Tech Boy, and Rita, the sole survivors of the teams who had accompanied them on their quests. Grant was looking around with something like unease.
A lot of people here, and I see campfires all down the valleys that run away from this place.
Kane nodded.
There's got to be hundreds of thousands of them. More have been arriving all the time. But most were waiting for us when we hiked in from Uluru, and they look to have been here for a while.
Bridget raised her head and looked at them.
Why, that would mean...
This is the main camp. The people around Uluru were bait. The Aborigines wanted the invaders to go there.
Billy the Talker turned a smiling, handsome face toward him.
Most perceptive, mate. Our ways aren't yours, and our agenda isn't either. And we're right sorry for any worries it's caused. But we told you straight, our aims and yours are in harmony. So just wait and watch. And whatever you do, please don't try to interfere in what goes on. For your sake and ours, and the future of humanity.
That's an encouraging build-up.
Into the circle stepped Lilga. She looked tiny in her ragged smock, very much the young child she was, yet she strode confidently as any queen to stand with her head held high and her heavy locks spilling down her shoulders, waiting. A flat-topped hump of rock, perhaps half a yard high, rose from the ground before her, which had been tamped down hard by tens of thousands of dancing bare feet. From the murmuring human ocean emerged Yindi, the projection that was Old Man walking beside him. They approached the rock. Yindi held forth the turtle to Lilga. She took it, turned it over in her hands, smiling delightedly as if it were the greatest toy ever. Then, solemnly but unable to completely suppress a smile, she handed it back to him. The shaman crouched and laid the carved malachite turtle on the anvil rock. Then he picked up a head-sized stone, raised it high, and brought it down violently, smashing the Mackenzie turtle to powder.
What?
Bridget Baptiste half rose. From behind, Rita touched her lightly on the arm. Bridget sat back down, looking troubled and confused. As Old Man looked on, his smile grave now, Yindi painstakingly scooped the green powder from the top of the rock into a clay bowl with his hand, brushing carefully to transfer as much as possible into the receptacle. The bowl obviously contained some sort of fluid, and into this he stirred the powder from the smashed figurine with what appeared to be a piece of polished bone. He stood, then, went to Lilga, and held the bowl to her.
My God! Lilga! She's just a little girl!
What do you mean?
She's not... She hasn't been taken over by one of the crew, has she? And this will cause her to be possessed, won't it? Her personality will be subsumed into someone else's. She'll die.
She and Domi looked at each other and then started to stand, reaching for their holstered hand blasters.
Dear Bridget.
Please.
She knows. It's been her destiny right along. And it must be, for she bears the genes of the Navigators.
There was no way Lilga could have heard any of their words over the vast, low susurration of sound, as loud as a great wind, yet as soft as the play of water in a fountain. Yet she looked up even as she reached for the bowl, caught Bridget's eye and then Domi's and Kane's, each in turn, and smiled and waved with pure child's joy. Then she took the bowl in both hands and drank. Her body convulsed. She flung the bowl away in a spasm that brought her head back and down so far her long locks brushed her heels.
Damn you! What have you done to her?
Bridget was on her feet now, eyes flashing, Domi at her side. They looked ready to take on all 250,000 Aborigines, or however many were assembled around the two campfires and the stricken little girl. Kane locked his hand on Bridget's wrist.
Whatever they did, it's done now. We can't put that bullet back in the blaster. Nothing can. Do you hear me, Baptiste?
Grant was similarly restraining Domi from launching unilateral war. Bridget looked at Kane with stricken eyes, then nodded. But she did not sit down. Down between the campfires, Lilga lay thrashing in the dust. Kane felt the skin on his own cheeks tauten until it threatened to split.
I don't like this one damn scrap better than you do, Baptiste. We played ball together, the girl and I.
Lilga stretched out full length on her back, kicked once, and lay still. Then, the little girl's body began to glow. It was as if every cell began to emit a gentle, golden radiance. She opened her eyes. Then she rose, not through any apparent agency of her muscles, but rather as if she lay on some sort of invisible hinged panel that swung her slowly upright. Overhead, Kane realized with a shock, the stars had been blotted as black clouds rushed together, seemingly from every point of the compass, to converge above the twin fires. Now they roiled as if about to birth a tornado.
Do they get twisters down here? Because if they do, they're fixing to have one.
Instead, the girl slowly raised her arms from her sides until they pointed up toward the ominous seethe of darkness. Her body shone so brightly they couldn't look at it. Golden light shot from her, a pillar of light that pierced the heart of the darkness and dispersed it. The column of golden light vanished. The glow from the child's body faded until it no longer hurt to look at her.
I have no idea what I just saw, but whatever it was, I have to say, it was impressive.
Yindi and Old Man had stepped back from Lilga when she accepted the bowl containing the drink made from the powdered turtle. Now Old Man approached her with deliberation.
You are Uluru the ship.
I am. Command me.
You are healed completely?
I am, O Navigator.
Then restore yourself to your original state.
It shall be done.
She closed her eyes as if in extreme concentration and raised her hands again. Suddenly, Old Man was standing on the promontory beside the onlookers from Cerberus.
It's done. I'm free.
Uluru the ship? Old Man, whatever did the child mean by that?
What she said, of course, Dr. Singh. The powdered turtle has awakened the ability coded within Lilga's genes of the Navigators, the most skilled adepts of all the crew. I must apologize for the traumatic side effects as memories and knowledge crashed in upon her. There is, sadly, no gentler way to effect a transformation of such magnitude, and no one else currently incarnated among the people was able to undergo it. Now she has the power to draw and direct energy from the very fabric of space, and to fully awaken and command the great vessel that brought our people here millennia ago.
He touched his painted breast and bowed.
Your humble servant.
You're the ship? How can you be a ship?
I am a sentient computer. I am the ship's mind and heart.
But if the ship is awakening, How come you're standing here conversing so casually with us?
It's an autonomous subroutine. Only the navigator can invoke it, and now she's channeling virtual energy, what you might describe as zero-point energy, Dr. Singh, into the actual physical vessel to fuel the transformation. It all requires no conscious effort or attention on my part. This will be young Coram Jerry with a message for us.
A young man came running down the spine of the rock thrust with his long hair flopping like tentacles about his shoulders.
Old man, you asked that we tell you when the ABCs called again, after the transformation ceremony.
ABCs?
The inviters.
Billy Handsome stepped up to explain.
Lad Coram Jerry's mislaid his manners. It means Aboriginal bum cleaners. We used it to get the white spewing once upon a time.
Sorry.
How'd they get our frequency?
I gave it to them. They have done my people, the people whom I have done my poor best to safeguard for 750 centuries, terrible hurt. And I am not without malice. I was built and programmed as a ship of war, as well as peace.
Kane looked around at Grant, who shrugged. He looked, one at a time, to Brigid, Domi, and Lakesh. Not even the director of Cerberus could find anything to say.
Come. We mustn't keep the God King waiting.
The comm unit had been set up in a little tent off in the woods near where the rock knee jutted from the slope. Vladek's image leered on the communicator screen.
So you're holed up in the mountains with the rest of the savages, Kane. It's a good place for you. I don't know if your little pals had anything to do with the weird pyrotechnic display over the mountains a few minutes ago, but it's going to take more than that bullshit to keep us from hunting you down like mad animals and exterminating you, especially once we get hold of Uluru's secrets.
The Cobaltville magistrate was outdoors, with the starry sky for a backdrop and the dark mass of Uluru itself vaguely visible over his right shoulder. Past his left shoulder could be seen the God King, sitting on a very ordinary camp stool, looking on with his usual expression of frosty disdain.
Why aren't they calling from the tent?
Probably doesn't smell too good right now.
Ah.
Old man turned to address the screen and Vladek.
The Sacred of Uluru. You and the God King, all of your expeditionary force, in fact, are about to experience the ultimate Sacred of Uluru firsthand. Rather before you anticipated.
Behind Vladek, Uluru began to glow, as Lilga's body had.
They meant it. It is the damn ship.
Impossible! Uluru is a single, huge boulder, a solid object. It has caves and passageways inside it. I was in them. But nothing that could possibly constitute the living quarters of a ship, much less propulsion or life support.
It is the ship. Not just a spaceship, but a dimensional ship. And it is also me.
What the fuck are you people raving about?
Vladek was seething. The God King had risen and approached a few steps toward the unit.
Why are you telling the enemy all this stuff, old man?
Because he is dead.
The great boulder was glowing more brightly. Behind Vladek and the God King, Kane could see motion as the invaders' encampment stirred awake, heard querulous voices raised, turning to surprise, awe, and fear.
Under the guidance of the Navigator's will, my friends, what you perceive as Uluru the Rock is itself beginning to change. The molecular bonds within are shifting, breaking. Its crystalline lattice structure alters, forming its interior back into the passages and compartments that once held our fugitive race, into life support systems, propulsion, weapons.
And the radiance is caused by
the simultaneous breaking of quadrillions of molecular bonds. It releases energy, lots of it. Specifically high-frequency radiation, invisible emanations from X-rays roaring up through gamma.
The God King's face was floating beside Vladek now like a strange moon, its perfection marred by something akin to fear.
What is the creature saying? What is happening? Vladek, I demand answers this instant!
Lethal radiation.
Old man smiled.
Enormous quantities.
Unlike Lilga during her transfiguration, Uluru was shifting wavelength visibly, getting whiter as it brightened. Already, Vladek and the Dewa Raja seemed to be standing in the day's full light.
What's happening is that you're fucked, Vladek. You, that freak next to you, your whole gang of Stonehearts.
And to prove I'm a bad winner, I just wanted to mention before you die that I always thought your face looked like something tattooed on the end of a blunt dick. In the background, Uluru now blazed unbearably white. A horrified look came over Vladek's face. He and the God King half turned toward the rock. Their faces softened like wax, began to melt. They seemed to turn insubstantial. The screen went black.
An annular pulse of extremely hard radiation has destroyed the sending set, my friends. It has radiated out from Uluru itself, which is to say, from me, from my substance, and instantly killed every living thing within a 20-mile radius.
What about us?
Distance in the mountain's mass protects you. Recall your inverse square law. And now, it is done. The war is over. The evil ones are destroyed.
Kane stood at the blank screen and felt relief wash over him. There would be more battles. The Barons were relentless. But for the moment, the Cerberus Exiles had prevailed. Outlander's Uluru Destiny is a graphic audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2004, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Michael Replogle, Kate Torrey, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton, Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, Dan Smith, and Brian Rogers. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Brian Patton, Chris Rowan, and Matt Webb. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another graphic audio title.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Daniel Wolfe, the youngest son of a nefarious clan of the old Empire, made his escape just before the Empire fell. On a stolen ship, he watched reports come in of the end of the world he once knew. But Daniel's only concern is to find the mysterious homeworld of the dreaded artificial intelligences known as Shub.
We are really getting awfully close to where Shub is supposed to be. It's not at all too late to turn around and get out of there fast.
We go on.
You really don't know anything about Shub, do you?
For most, it would be considered suicide, but for Daniel, it is a rescue mission. He believes Shub has his father Jacob in its clutches, or what's left of him. But there is much more that Daniel will learn when he comes face to face with the enemies of humanity.
I've come so far. There are things I need to tell you.
Later. For now, there are things you must see. The AIs require it.
Meanwhile, on the planet Golgotha, Owen Deathstalker enters into a bargain with a member of Daniel's family.
You see, Owen, we have a lot in common after all. That's why I want you to marry me.
And it will change forever the Deathstalker's life. Deathstalker Honor, Episode 2, The Enemies of Humanity.
Been working on that interphaser for hours.
Any luck?
No, I can't get it to engage.
Have you tried this?
No, boy, what did you do?
I just readjusted
it. It won't cycle down.
It'll be fine.
Baptiste, have you finished with... Baptiste? Phil Boyd? Shit.
Having been transported to a far-flung region of Cambodia, Bridget Baptiste, Brewster Philboyd, and Nora Penick find themselves surrounded by competing factions, hidden interests, and threats to their lives.
I'm going after them.
Me and Grant will go with you.
No, I have to do this myself. You'll hear from me.
Now, Kane has to deal with the exotic threats of Cambodia, save his three friends, and face his destiny once again. But this time, he must do it alone. Outlanders number 32, Evil Abyss.
If you're just joining us, this is Bart Bell and you're listening to Shore to Shore. Tonight we've been talking about the possible existence of a shadow government within the United States. Our next caller is Doug from Washington, D.C. You're on the air, Doug.
I'm at a phone booth, Bart. Now I'm going to say this quick and then I'm going to get off the phone before this call is traced.
I beg your pardon?
Listen, Bart. There is a shadow government. I've got proof. It's been around for decades. To keep it clandestine, the positions in it are passed down from family member to family member. All the children of a particular employee have been specially trained to replace their parent when the time comes.
That's sort of a scary version of nepotism you're considering there, Doug.
Oh, I'm not considering it, Bart. This is the real thing. Hang on. It's clear. There's a shadow president, too, and he's got access to the entire shadow government. He also runs the corporations that finance it.
Wait a minute. They have their own financing in the eventuality that they're ever called into action?
Oh, I got news for you, Bart. The shadow president's not waiting for the call-up. He's been at work. So's the whole shadow government. He's got his own agenda.
What kind of agenda are we talking here?
Takeover. Plain and simple. He doesn't agree with the way things are going in this country, and he's decided it's time to step in. And in his government, every employee is loyal to him and him alone.
I see. Does this alleged despot have a timetable for his coup, Doug?
It's slated for tomorrow night, during the president's address to Congress.
I see. Well, we wouldn't have much time to save ourselves, would we?
The wheels are already in motion, Bart. There's no stopping this guy. He already has people in place across the country.
Doug, he's still there. Doug from Washington.
Sorry, wrong number.
Holy shit.
David Campbell, our unelected shadow president. He's aided terrorists, financed assassinations, sabotaged foreign affairs. Tomorrow night, he brings his own definition of the Patriot Act to your front door. And the only thing in his way are the men and women of Stony Man Farm. Prepare yourself. This is the big one. Stony Man number 79. Promise to defend.
Bayou Lafourche, Louisiana. Swamp country is full of many perils for the unwary. Gators, snapping turtles, rattlers, and cottonmouth moccasins. But the bayou hides even deadlier predators.
Take cover!
Mac Bolan and his brother Johnny team up to infiltrate and destroy a Merc training camp deep in the bayou. But the mission turns out to be more than they bargained for.
Can't outrun them. We have to fight.
They'll run circles around us in airboats. We don't have a chance.
Would you rather surrender?
Hell no!
Keely Ross, federal agent rescued from the training camp by the Bolan brothers, joins them in their battle against not just mercenaries, but an old foe as well, the mob.
We got a situation in Louisiana. We need to find out who's behind this thing and take them out before they do more damage, yes?
Right away, boss. No sweat.
Mac, Johnny, and Keely are pulled into a conspiracy of international proportions in The Executioner number 308. Into the Fire, part one of the Ord Crime Trilogy.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.